which is which problems can be solved with polynomial resources and which ones cannot. And in lecture one on Saturday, we mentioned the quantum Church-Turing thesis, which is in a way a proposal for an answer to this question. So the quantum Church-Turing thesis proposes that the answer to this question is BQP, the set of things, the set of computational problems that we can solve in polynomial time in our universe is exactly the set of problems you could solve with polynomial-sized quantum circuits made from some standard elementary gate set. So this is really a pretty bold claim, because if it's true, it means that standard quantum circuits can efficiently, that is, in polynomial time, simulate all other physical systems that exist. And so then the big question is this really true? And to probe this question, we can look at all different kinds of physical systems that we can see in nature and then evaluate one by one, can we simulate these with polynomial overhead using standard quantum computers? So last time, we worked through one sort of case, which was non-relativistic quantum mechanics in one dimension. So we just had like a single particle on a line and some potential. And what we saw was that the corresponding unitary time evolution generated by a Hamiltonian like this can be approximated to within epsilon, so you could have some unitary made by a quantum circuit, which approximates this time evolution. And we can do this using polynomially many gates as a function of t and epsilon. So, that's a good start. We've seen how to do time evolution induced by this simple kind of Hamiltonian that might be the first one you see as an undergrad. But that leaves still a lot of questions left. So in particular, what about state preparation? What about measurement at the end of the simulation? What about more degrees of freedom, such as, well, what if this is in three dimensions instead of one dimension? What if this is 100 particles instead of one particle? Other degrees of freedom, like, for example, what if we have spins, and so on. What about fermionic statistics? Can we anti-symmetrize everything? And then what about more elaborate kinds of quantum systems, such as quantum field theory, or maybe even quantum gravity models? So really, the theme for today's talk is to go through here and explore how we can really address these problems. And the ones I'll focus on, I don't have time to go through everything, so the ones I'll focus on are state preparation, measurement, and simulating quantum field theories. And as far as how do we simulate spin systems, how do we go to higher dimensions, what about fermionic statistics, I'll basically just assert to you that we can handle these problems. We kind of understand fairly direct generalizations of these techniques from last lecture, which can be applied if the Hamiltonian is, say, some easing model or something instead of a particle on a line. So, let's start with the measurement problem. So, of course, if we do this time evolution, it's not really a complete simulation algorithm unless you have three steps. First, you prepare some physically realistic starting state, then you simulate the unitary time evolution, and then at the end, you measure some observables that you want to learn about. So if you recall from lecture one, what we did is we ran our simulation in the position basis. So our states were something like this. Ultimately, they're states of qubits. So we have bit strings of length n. For each corresponding bit string, we have some amplitude. And here's our bit string written out inside the ket. And in our simulation, we were thinking of these bit strings as representing particle position, which is some, for one dimension, it's just a real number. And then we were just writing these numbers in binary with n bits of precision. So those are the kind of states we were working with on our quantum computer to simulate our physical system. So the easiest kind of measurement we could do is we could just measure the bits. So in quantum algorithms lingo, this is called measuring in the computational basis. You just go through these bits one by one. You measure like a sigma z operator that tells you, is this a one, is this a zero? So if you do that measurement, then what you'll be sampling from is a probability distribution over x, which is given by absolute square of psi of x. So you're sampling from the probability distribution, the spatial probability distribution defined by the wave function. And in some cases, that information might be what you want to know. Where is the particle? What's maybe the spread and the particle's position and things like that. But in many other cases, that might also just not be what the question you're really interested in. So in particular, what if we want to measure energy? That's, I think, a good illustrative example. That's not something you can easily determine just by measuring in the computational basis like that, because you don't learn anything about the momentum information. Okay, so now suppose you want to measure an energy. It turns out that we can do this using a method which John Watrous touched upon in his lecture, which is Kataev's method of phase estimation. And so for simplicity, suppose that you have some state psi, which is an eigenstate of your Hamiltonian. This is an example which is a little easier to understand. So we have psi stored in our register of qubits. We want to run some quantum circuit, which will in the end tell us what this energy E is. So we can do this using a relatively simple but clever trick. So we prepare a superposition into a control register. And here's our state psi. And we can build a circuit which, if the control register contains the number T, written out in binary, then it will correspondingly simulate the application of this Hamiltonian for time t. You can actually see how to do that if you had a bunch of control lines and then you have little controlled operations e to the minus I h, e to the minus I 2h, e to the minus I 4H, then whatever number is written in binary up here is the amount of time that you're simulating time evolution for down here. This control line just means if this bit is a 1, apply this, otherwise do nothing. Here's our psi. So this is not a hard circuit to understand, ultimately. So what happens if we apply this? So now, recall these slashes on these lines mean that these are registers of qubits. So this is like, say, n qubits, and this is m qubits. These ones represent some quantum state, and these ones represent a number. So now, after we've applied this operation, what do we have? Well, recalling that this thing is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, this time evolution is just going to induce a phase. So we have superposition over times t, and we have some phase e to the minus I e t, and then psi over here. And we could rewrite this as follows. All we've done is emphasize this tensor product structure, and we've moved this phase out here. It's just a phase. We can associate it with any register we want. So it's a little bit funny because you think, well, this circuit is acting on this register, but the phase ends up back on this register. So that's one of these slightly counterintuitive quantum things. But what you notice here is now we have a plane wave in this register. So all we have to do is an inverse Fourier transform. And now at this point, what our quantum state will be is E written in bits and psi. So this is Kataev's phase estimation. And this is not infinite precision. So basically what happens here is that your resolution in energy goes like 1 over T max, the biggest amount of time that you evolve for. This is sort of analogous to the energy time uncertainty principle. Or another way of looking at it is if you have m bits of if you're writing down t with m bits, you're going to get e with m bits. Remember, this Fourier transform is just some unitary thing. Doesn't change the number of qubits. So the biggest time here is 2 to the m. Or if we express that as t max equals 2 to the m, epsilon equals 2 to the minus m, that's the same thing as what I just wrote. And the cost of doing this basically is dominated by the cost of evolving according to a long time. So if we want high precision, we have to evolve for longer in the simulation, and that costs more gates. But we can measure to any polynomial precision. So more generally, so this is what happens on an eigenstate. On a general state, you'll have some superposition, so you have some amplitudes for different eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. And if we run this circuit, you can guess what happens. You're just going to get some probability I, which is the absolute square of AI, basically. So we can measure in the eigenbasis of this operator H. And the same trick can work for other operators. It doesn't have to be a Hamiltonian. It just has to be something Hermitian and something such that the corresponding e to the minus I operator t is something you can efficiently implement using quantum circuits. So more generally, this lets us measure efficiently in the eigenbasis of, say, momentum operators, angular momentum operators. We can do equal time correlation functions this way, measuring operators like sigma zi, sigma zj for different lattice sites ij, and so on. We can do this using phase estimation. And, you know, oftentimes what you want to know is an expectation value like this. We can always get that by measuring in the eigenbasis. We're getting more information by measuring in the eigenbasis. We just repeat the measurement many times and average over results. That's telling us an expectation value. Okay. So let me now comment on state preparation. And this is really the hardest part of quantum simulation algorithms in many cases. We have fairly general methods for simulating Hamiltonian time evolution, and we have fairly general methods for measuring operators at the end. But for state preparation, we don't actually expect there to exist really general methods, because preparation of generic states is something that we don't think can be done in polynomial time on a quantum computer. It's only special states that we can make. And there are a few arguments for that. One is that there's just too many states in the Hilbert space. So there's just a simple counting argument where if you say, divide Hilbert space and tile it into little epsilon-sized patches, on n qubits, the number of such patches is going to be doubly exponential in n. In contrast, the number of quantum circuits acting on n qubits with polynomially many gates is only singly exponential. So the vast majority of quantum states in the Hilbert space cannot be made by any polynomial-sized quantum circuit. So that argument is very simple, and it's actually a proof. Now, you might say, OK, well, most states in the Hilbert space are kind of unphysical. So nature doesn't make them either. Who cares? And one thing that might hit a little closer to home, though, is you could also show that for a lot of Hamiltonians, the ground state is NP-hard to construct, or even in some cases worse than NP-hard, something called QMA-hard. Such problems are not expected to be solved in polynomial time for the worst case instances on quantum or classical computers. So those are other examples, slightly more specific examples of states that we don't believe we can make. So now let's talk about state preparation. So there's quite a few different state preparation methods. As I've said, we don't have a really general purpose method that we can just apply all the time, unlike, say, for time evolution, where we have Trotter-Suzuki formulas that are kind of solve the problem pretty universally. So instead, what we have is kind of a large collection of fairly specialized tricks for different cases. And so I won't just go through a long laundry list of such tricks for the rest of this lecture. Instead, I'll present one of them to you, which I think is particularly powerful and particularly interesting, and that's adiabatic state preparation. And I'll explain it by giving a framework, which is adiabatic quantum computing, and which is often a good way of describing certain classes of quantum algorithms. And then I'll show in particular how that's applicable to state preparation. So before I go on to that, are there any questions at this point? I should mention that I encourage you to ask questions throughout the throughout this lecture. Yeah. Oh, because for these, yeah, that's right. So for these kinds of Hamiltonians where it's NP-hard to find the ground state, these are kind of glassy systems which in real life do, in fact, get stuck in some kind of metastable states. Good question. Any others? Okay. So for the first part of these two lectures, I've been telling you a lot about the quantum circuit model. I've argued that this is a universal model. It captures everything that quantum computers can do. And so maybe we should be satisfied with that. Why do we want to go through the trouble of learning other models of quantum computation if we've spent all this time arguing that that one is universal and captures the whole power of quantum computers? But there is a reason to learn about other models, which is that they provide different perspectives by which to think about quantum algorithms. Some quantum algorithms, which are very obvious in one model, you might probably never think of if you were working within another model. And so we're going to approach the state preparation problem from the adiabatic point of view. So adiabatic quantum computation is a Hamiltonian-based computational model. And so we let H of S be some parameterized family of Hamiltonians, which vary smoothly with S. So for example, and this is a commonly used example in practice, you might just have some initial Hamiltonian, which I'll call H init, and some final Hamiltonian, H final. And what our goal is to prepare the ground state of H final. That's our goal in an adiabatic computation. And so we could vary this S over time from 0 to 1, and at the beginning we'll be applying H init, at the end we'll be applying H final. So what our computational scheme is one, prepare ground state of H init, and two, evolve according to H of T over big T from time 0 to big T. So in other words, we start with S equals 0 and we slowly crank it up until we reach S equals 1. And why do we do that? Well, the reason we do that is because the adiabatic theorem tells us that if we do this variation of S slowly enough, then the system will behave quasi-statically. It will track the instantaneous ground state of H of S as we vary S. And so what that means is, you know, our dynamics is the solution to Schrodinger's equation. And that will be approximately some dynamical phase times the instantaneous ground state at each moment. So we vary S with T according to some schedule. And this dynamical phase just has to do with the energy. So it's like phi is 0 to So that's the model, but there are two questions. One is, how do we prepare the ground state of H init, and how slowly do we really need to go? So of course, if our goal is to prepare quantum states, then if we start by assuming we can prepare quantum states, we're being a bit silly. So what we have to do is we choose H init so that it has a ground state, which is something that's obviously easy to prepare. And one class of states that's definitely easy to prepare is tensor product states, states that are just something on this qubit, something on this qubit, no entanglement. So some examples of that could be the all zero state. So we can write this as a tensor power, or we could start with the uniform superposition state, could also write this is just a tensor power also. So those are, I would say, the two most common choices. So that's how we convince ourselves that we're not sort of cheating somehow by assuming we can have some states and forgetting to account for the full complexity of our process. But now to judge the complexity of an algorithm, what we usually care most about is runtime, which is this big T. So we know from the adiabatic theorem that in the limit of big T going to infinity, we really do track the ground state. But, of course, we don't want big T to go to infinity. In fact, we want it to be as small as possible, and we want to know how big it needs to be. And that's told to us by quantitative versions of the adiabatic theorem. So Often people refer to the adiabatic theorem. It's not quite right. There's a number of different ones with slightly different conditions, slightly different conclusions. I'll just tell you my favorite one. Which is from Elgart and Hagedorn in 2012. So to track, I'll state it a little bit informally, to track the ground state, it suffices to take big T scaling as this, where here this gamma is the minimum eigenvalue gap between the ground state and first excited state. Okay. So this basically tells you, gives you a systematic way of proving that under certain circumstances, these are efficient algorithms. Now, one thing I haven't told you is what this O tilde notation means. That's just a computer science notation which says, this is the asymptotic scaling. We're neglecting not only constant factors out front, but also any logarithmic factors. If we didn't have the O tilde, we'd be neglecting the constant factors up front and the subleading terms, but we'd be keeping the log factors. So that's what we're doing here. So this quantity gamma is called the minimal gap. And oftentimes in designing adiabatic algorithms, estimating this gap is really the hard part. Proposing the algorithm is usually not the hardest part. Analyzing its runtime is hard. But as you can see, this is like pretty naturally suited to state preparation problems. If the state we want to prepare is the ground state of some final Hamiltonian, then maybe we can do it this way. If it's one of these spin glass Hamiltonians, then we're out of luck. But if there's some adiabatic path which connects us between some initial Hamiltonian with an unentangled ground state, let's say, one of these tensor product states, to this final Hamiltonian, then we could just follow that path and prepare the state. So it has a lot to do, whether you can prepare these states has a lot to do with whether they lie in the same quantum phase as some initial Hamiltonian with a simple ground state. So it's a very nice physics problem. It's a field in quantum algorithms where having a physics background is maybe more advantageous than having a computer science background. Okay, so that's the basic model. There are a few technical things to keep in mind. First of all, you don't want to just say, let's write down arbitrary Hamiltonians. Let's imagine some bizarre 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrices with completely strange matrix elements in there. We want these to be physically realistic Hamiltonians. And one restriction which seems to suffice to achieve physical realism and give us a reasonable computational model, which is kind of cleanly stateable, is that we restrict to k-qubit interactions. So for example, if we choose k equals 2, then the kind of terms we have in our Hamiltonians here would be things like Pauli operators and products of Paulis, which would couple pairs of qubits. And that would be like k equals 2. We would have these kind of things. Also with sigma y's and couplings of different types and so on. And so what we know is that for any constant k greater than or equal to 2, this model is polynomially equivalent to the quantum circuit model. So unpacking that statement, what it means is that each of these things can simulate the other efficiently. So what we have here is quantum circuits and adiabatic quantum computation efficiently simulates in one way and efficiently simulates in the other way. Now, so quantum circuits simulating adiabatic quantum computation, this Hamiltonian time evolution model, maybe you can guess how this works. We just use our same tricks that we've been using all along, these Suzuki Trotter formulas. We can take this continuous time Hamiltonian evolution and map it into some corresponding quantum circuit with polynomially many gates that implements that same unitary time evolution. Adiabatic quantum computation to simulate quantum circuits, this is quite a bit less obvious how to do that. And this was shown in a paper by Aharonov and collaborators in, well, it was published in a journal in 2007, although the preprint's really from 2004. Unfortunately, that happens in computer science journals a lot. And this is using a trick called the Feynman-Kitaev clock Hamiltonian. Which is something that I think will be very much of interest to the It From Qubit crowd. It sort of encodes time into entanglement in a certain sense. And so I won't talk about this, but let me just advertise that this afternoon at his focus lecture, Adam Boland will be telling you all about this. And I believe it will also come up in Dorita Haranov's lecture on Thursday. I think it's Thursday. Okay, so we'll just say, okay, we know how to do this equivalence. We won't go into the details, but let's see what are some consequences of it. Yeah.
So in your back, you see just a relaxation method, you're trying to find the true ground state of starting from something else.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, you have a speak tricky situation where you don't get stuck with force.
Yeah. So I mean maybe the most obvious way of trying to produce ground states is by cooling. But there are a couple of downsides to that. Which are, one is maybe cooling is somewhat of a more classical process, so you might have the intuition that maybe this won't give you quantum advantage over classical computing. It's a little unclear. The other maybe even bigger problem with cooling from the point of view of a theorist like myself is it tends to be very hard to analyze. In this adiabatic state preparation method, we have this nice characterization given by the adiabatic theorem. So then our problem reduces to, can we compute this eigenvalue gap of this asymptotic class of matrices? And there are all kinds of different techniques coming from both mathematics and physics for doing that, using spectral graph theory, using the theory of quantum phase transitions, and using all kinds of stuff. So that's the good thing about adiabatic, is we've got some tools to deal with it in a systematic way. Well, so maybe. I mean, it's the thesis, I would say, is more about what is the computational power that nature has not necessarily that it makes utmost use of it all the time. So, yeah, I guess I would phrase it like that. Uh-huh. Yeah, so the adiabatic theorem applies just the same to something in the middle of the spectrum. The only difference is this gap is now just the gap to above or below, like this little range that separates it. So you can totally use it to prepare excited states. Using it to prepare thermal states, I think, just honestly hasn't been studied that much. There have been some other methods proposed for preparing thermal states. I'm not an expert on them. Another thing you can do is suppose what you want is not something like just an eigenstate, but maybe some wave packet, which is some controlled superposition over a certain energy range. You can use adiabatic computing to prepare those kind of states, although there are some technical gotchas that you have to kind of concern yourself with, which we'll see in maybe 20 minutes or so. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so a typical case would be we choose H and it. So the question is, what about the spectrum of the initial Hamiltonian? So it's true, we want to make sure that doesn't have a small gap. So oftentimes a good choice is here's sum over the qubits, and this is sigma x I. So this has gap of 2, and the ground state is the uniform superposition. And then the first excited state is a constant distance away. It's highly degenerate, but I was thinking for preparing states in the middle of the spectrum, then. Oh, yes. Then you can definitely run into problems. That's true, yeah. OK. So what are some applications of this equivalence between adiabatic quantum computing and quantum circuits, which I just erased? After all, I've been really harping on this whole proving equivalences thing throughout my series of lectures, and so let's see in a specific example like what it buys us. So one thing that it buys us is what you might call interoperability in kind of computer science-y language. And so think of what tools we have so far. We've got this tool, which is state preparation. And this is in the adiabatic model of computation. And in the circuit model, we have this tool, which is Suzuki Trotter formulas for time evolution of closed systems. And we also kind of have this other tool, which is measurement of observables by phase estimation. But now what are we going to do? It's kind of like we have these different kinds of Legos and they don't fit together. You know, this is in the adiabatic model. These two are in the circuit model. And to make a complete quantum algorithm, we want to plug them together. First state preparation, then time evolution, then measurement. So what are you going to do? Are you going to build some hybrid kind of quantum computer that can implement both these slowly time-varying Hamiltonians and do gates. I mean, maybe you could imagine such a thing, but in general, different models are not necessarily so compatible. I mean, it's even more stark if you have some pair of models which are not even acting on the same kinds of degrees of freedom. Maybe one's on qubits, another one's on qutrits, or one's on qubits, another one's on anyons. How are you going to plug these kind of subroutines together into one coherent algorithm? Well, what you can do is avoid that whole problem. You don't plug them together. What you do is you take this tool and convert it into a circuit model algorithm by simulating it. So we just use our generic simulation rule. We can always take any adiabatic algorithm, simulate it using quantum circuits. So now we have quantum circuit simulation of adiabatic state preparation. And now we have three building blocks that we really can just plug together into a complete algorithm. So this is like a concrete example about why these simulation results really are meaningful and useful. A second application is fault tolerance. So I mentioned last time a foundational thing for quantum computing is this threshold theorem, which says that if our error rate per operation is below some constant, then we can use active error correction and perform arbitrarily long computations reliably. There's no such theorem known for the adiabatic model. So if you discover some great new adiabatic algorithm that gives you an exponential speed up for something, how do you know that that's real? How do you know that that's not just an illusion, kind of an artifact of your failure to properly take into account errors? Well, the way you know is that you can always take this, in principle, take this adiabatic algorithm, convert it into a circuit model algorithm, which will then be fault tolerant. And three, these can serve as architectures for trying to build actual quantum computers in the lab. They give you different ideas about how to try to build these things. Okay, so now we've got these three tools. We know how to plug them together, and we can now apply them to kind of the main meat of this talk, which is simulating quantum field theories on a quantum computer. So, are there any questions before we move on to phase two, applying the tools instead of collecting them? Okay, so all right, so what's the motivation for this problem? So first of all, we basically know efficient quantum algorithms for lots of simulation problems. We want to simulate chemistry. We kind of know how to do that in polynomial time. Current research is not, can we do this in polynomial time? It's, let's try to improve the efficiency more and more and try to solve real interesting problems with relatively small quantum computers that we might have in the next 5 to 10 years. Condensed matter. Pretty much same story. Hubbard model, spin glasses, whatever you want. We kind of understand how to simulate those. Quantum field theory, we've got partial progress. So there are some papers I wrote with John Preskill and Keith Lee, which give quantum algorithms to simulate certain kind of simple textbook examples of quantum field theories. 5-4 theory the massive case and gross Nebe model, the massive case. So one's bosonic and one's fermionic. But there's still ways to go to fill in all the tools we need to simulate a really serious quantum field theory like the standard model. And of course, you can ask, what about quantum gravity? Can we simulate that on quantum computers? And like basically, as far as I can tell, nobody has any idea. That's like a wide open problem. And I think it's a very interesting problem because that's a very serious challenge to the quantum Turing thesis. You know, there's good intuitions to believe, yeah, probably quantum computers can, with polynomial overhead, simulate quantum field theories pretty generally, at least renormalizable ones. Here, it could go either way. I mean, who knows? Yeah, that's one of the things that makes this kind of a hard problem. Yeah, so you could say, well, okay, in ADS CFT, on one side we have the conformal field theory. Let's try simulating the conformal field theory on a quantum computer. And we don't actually know right now how to simulate conformal quantum field theories as like a direct corollary of what we've already got, because as we'll see, in our algorithms, we were using adiabatic state preparation, which could run into problems if you don't have some nice mass gap that's protecting you against adiabatic errors. But probably that can be overcome by other state preparation tricks. And there's another question, which is, suppose you have some question, your original question is something directly on the gravity side. There's two parts to answering the question. One is doing the dictionary, translating it back into some question about the conformal field theory. And then step two is answering that question with your quantum computer. Either one of those two steps could have high computational complexity, I think. And also, the question you end up with on the CFT side might be something kind of strange and non-local, where in that case, it's not quite so obvious that it's efficient on a quantum computer. So I think there are like several pretty important questions to ask about that, but I think in general that the intuition gives an interesting path to pursue anyway. Did you have a comment? Oh, okay, yeah. Oh, yeah. So that question was about simulating quantum gravity on a quantum computer using ADS CFT correspondence, the CFT side being a quantum field theory, which maybe we have some idea about how to simulate on quantum computers. Okay, so basically, the challenges at this point to the quantum Church-Turing thesis, this assertion that we can simulate everything with quantum computers, the real challenges there come from high-energy physics at this point. The low-energy stuff we've got sort of under control. So why might simulating quantum field theory be different from simulating the things that we already know how to simulate? Do we just get quantum algorithms for simulating quantum field theory as kind of like easy corollaries of the quantum algorithms we already have for simulating condensed matter and stuff like that? So, you know, since I'm a co-author of a paper about how to simulate quantum field theories in a quantum computer, you can probably guess that I'm going to try to argue to you that this is something non-trivial. And some reasons why it's non-trivial are, so first of all, the field has infinitely many degrees of freedom, even within a finite volume. The particle number is no longer conserved. And of course, quantum field theories can be relativistic. They will be in the cases that I'm looking at, some Lorentz invariant theories. And so if you have some quantum algorithm which simulates quantum many-body physics, which runs polynomially as a function of the number of degrees of freedom, or polynomially as a function of the number of particles, then that doesn't automatically, as an immediate corollary, give you a polynomial time quantum algorithm for simulating a quantum field theory, because those numbers are not so well-defined anymore. Okay. So, another reason why we care about this problem is that our classical algorithms, despite having been developed over many decades, still don't cover all the cases that we would really care about. So you could kind of make a chart. Of different cases you want to study. So there's like weakly coupled theories, strongly coupled. And then the things we might want to calculate are static quantities, like, say, mass ratios, for example, and dynamic quantities, like, say, scattering cross-sections. And so for weak coupling, we have an algorithm which is so efficient, oftentimes, that we don't even really think of it as an algorithm because we can carry it out on pencil and paper with our own brains. We don't even need a computer to crunch through it for us. And that's Feynman diagrams, these perturbative methods. But they break down at strong coupling. And in fact, not just at strong coupling, also if you want to go to asymptotically high precision, this is not a suitable method because in most cases, these are just asymptotic expansions, not convergent ones. For static quantities, we can always go to imaginary time. So this is kind of covered. And then we could use lattice Monte Carlo methods, like what people do in lattice gauge theory on big supercomputers when they're trying to compute things about QCD. But then the point is, this box is empty. We don't really have a good classical efficient algorithm for computing dynamic quantities like scattering probabilities in strongly coupled quantum field theories or with asymptotically high precision. So this is kind of our opportunity. This is the place where quantum computers might be able to sort of swoop in and save the day. So that, yeah. Yes, yes. Yeah, so that's an excellent comment. In some sense, once you compute, say, imaginary time correlation functions, you can try to analytically continue them to real time. And in practice, what happens is that this is problematic because this analytic continuation process kind of magnifies errors, and so it really boils down to a problem of precision. Yeah, there are definitely other problems that arise too. Fermionic sign problems, fermionic doubling problems. So there are plenty of limitations to these methods. Okay, so I should mention one other thing is, should you hold out hope for some classical algorithm that could simulate this whole box? It could tell you everything about quantum field theories. Do you think that we'll ever discover such a thing that runs in polynomial time on classical computers? I think there are actually good complexity theoretic reasons to think that the answer to this is no. Such an algorithm does not exist. We can never discover it. And a way to think about that is, think of the standard model, for example. This will describe all the apparatus that someone like John Martinez or Chris Monroe builds in their laboratories, building a quantum computer. And so an arbitrary quantum computation, say Shor's factoring algorithm, or some other quantum computation solving a problem which we don't think can be solved in polynomial time classically, is embeddable within this quantum field theory framework. So some quantum field theory simulations, namely classical simulations of a quantum field theory describing a quantum computer doing Shor's algorithm, have got to fail unless factoring could be done in polynomial time classically, which we think it can't. So basically, a more complexity theoretic way to say it is, under the assumption that BQP is not equal to P, that quantum computers and classical computers really are distinct in their power, we should not expect to ever find one universal classical algorithm for simulating quantum field theory. Okay, so that's the motivation. And now what are we actually going to do with our quantum computer? So first of all, what problem are we going to solve? So here's our problem. We should be precise. We're going to do a scattering problem. So the input to our problem is basically list of momenta of incoming particles, typically two. And the output is momenta of outgoing particles produced by the scattering process. So we have some pair of particles coming in. We aim them so that they collide. And in general, a whole bunch of particles with all different momenta come out. And this is what we want to learn. And so basically, this is kind of a problem of computing S matrix entries. It's a scattering problem, very standard. One thing I should mention, though, about it is it's different from what a theorist does. It's not that we say, OK, here's some matrix element. We want to compute it and write it down with some number of digits of precision. What we're doing here with our quantum computer is sampling from the probability distribution that this set of amplitudes defines, just like what an experiment does. And so by running the simulation many times, you learn something about the S matrix. That's what we demand from our simulation. If you ask for individual matrix elements to n bits of precision, that may actually be demanding too much. You can't learn that from an experiment either. You can only learn these things to polynomial precision, you know, epsilon 1 over square root of number of trials kind of information. So that's what we demand from our quantum computer too. So our example case is 5-4 theory. So let me write it down for you. So the high energy people in the audience would probably describe it by the Lagrangian density, which is just like this. We've seen it make an appearance before in other lectures because it's just a very nice, simple quantum field theory, which illustrates the essence of quantum field theory without getting us mired into too many extra technical details. So that's the Lagrangian density of the theory I'm going to talk about. And you know, the reason that high energy theorists like to describe it this way is because this Lagrangian density is what appears into path integrals. You know, a real-time path integral would be something like d phi, So that's why this is. Yes. So we restricted our attention to 1 plus 1, 2 plus 1, and 3 plus 1. 3 plus 1 is a little bit different from the other cases because then it's only an effective field theory. In 1 plus 1 and 2 plus 1, it really does have a continuum limit, and it's super renormalizable. So those are like the very nicest cases. And I'll just pretty much focus on 1+1 dimension for the rest of this lecture, just to keep things simple and concrete. So as we can usually do in physics, we can convert from a Lagrangian formulation into a Hamiltonian formulation. And this is a little bit less desirable to most field theorists because the Lorentz invariance of the theory is now a little bit less manifest. It's still there, but it's kind of obfuscated. But on the other hand, it's more convenient for quantum information because we think of our quantum computers in terms of Hamiltonians normally, and Hamiltonian simulation is something we know something about. So now, our theory looks like this. And what does this mean? Well, now in a Hamiltonian formulation, phi and pi are operators. More precisely, they're operator-valued functions of space. So for every location in space, we have a corresponding pair of operators, pi and phi, which are canonically conjugate. Oh, so what I'm doing is capital D is the dimension of space-time, and little d is the dimension of space. Oh, yeah, then this one should be D. That's right, yeah. Sorry. Okay, thanks. So now, at each location in space, pi and phi are a canonically conjugate pair of operators. So here's our commutation relation. Phi of x, pi of y equals I delta function dimension d of x minus y times the identity operator. So this is just like x for if these are at the same location in space, their commutator is proportional to I times the identity operator. That's just like x and p in undergrad quantum mechanics. So in particular, the eigenbasis of phi and the eigenbasis of pi are related to one another by a Fourier transform. So this is still not quite suitable for a quantum computer. We have space as continuous. These expressions are still maybe a little bit formalistic. They've got delta functions in them. And how do we parse this notion? But well, one thing we can do, which is sort of helpful in terms of conceptually clarifying what we really mean in terms of concrete mathematical objects, and which is also good when we want to put things on a computer, is we can discretize space. So now we put this thing on some lattice. I'll call the lattice omega. I'll stick with one-dimensional example for now. We have a bunch of lattice points. Just for convenience, we might as well put periodic boundary conditions on there. And I'll call the lattice spacing A. And so now our Hamiltonian is something that looks, on this lattice, it looks just like some kind of very ordinary many-body physics Hamiltonian. So if we discretize this, we're now just replacing with a sum over lattice sites. I'll put factors of the lattice spacing here and there to keep the dimensions of all the different quantities the same as what they would be in continuum quantum field theory. So now we have something that's really concrete and not at all mysterious or frightening. And our commutation relation between phi and pi is like this. Where this is now just a Kronecker delta. So now if you look at this, this is just some many-body quantum mechanics problem. And so the way we can think in terms of Hamiltonians and wave functions, to think in terms of a concrete wave function, we need to choose a basis. So one basis we can choose is we can choose the basis defined by the phi operators at all the different sites. So if we have phi of x for x in the lattice, this set of operators is a complete commuting set of operators. So we can write down the simultaneous eigenvalues of each of these operators, and that uniquely defines a basis state. Those span the Hilbert space. And correspondingly, the wave function we could write some wave functions as a function of time in our simulation. Let's just number these lattice sites from 1 to n for convenience for now. So we have all these different variables, some amplitude that depends on those variables and time, and then the corresponding basis state defined by these eigenvalues of these operators. So we can describe our wave function like that. Earlier this week, we talked about wave functionals. That's what this becomes when this lattice spacing is taken to zero. So now we've got really something we can put onto a quantum computer. We've got n of these classical variables. If we represent each of them with m bits of precision, then we can store the state using n times m qubits. So in the end, these are numbers. We can write them using binary to some precision. And so this superposition over different classical field configurations is a superposition over different numbers. Now that we've discretized space, that can be represented as a superposition over different bit strings. A superposition over different bit strings is a state of a set of qubits. It's a state of a quantum computer. Oh, yeah, they're real numbers. Yes. So there's two discretizations involved in our simulation. One is we're discretizing space. The secondly, at each lattice site, we're discretizing the value of phi. And so there's a little technical section in our paper about those discretization errors. It turns out that that's not really one of the key issues. Those discretization errors are pretty easy to deal with, especially because as we choose m qubits per site, we've now got exponential in m amount of precision. So we don't need very tight bounds on our convergence because we can just go to lots of bits. Yeah? So far, I have not discretized time, but ultimately, discretization of time is kind of taken care of by our Suzuki trotter stepping in the end. Yeah. Yeah, it's maybe a little bit unusual compared to what most people do. So like in a lattice QCD calculation or something, you think of some space-time lattice. Here, we still have a spatial lattice very straightforwardly. We're kind of conceptually thinking of time as being continuous. In the end, we discretize time using Suzuki Trotter. If we use high-order Suzuki Trotter, discretization of time is not quite so conceptually simple as like, oh, we have a lattice in time. But it's sort of like a lattice in time. Yeah. OK. So now we have an idea about how we're going to store the state of our quantum fields on the quantum computer. But then the next question is, OK, how are we going to implement the dynamics of these things? How are we going to do the state preparation, time evolution, and measurement? So the time evolution part, as I've kind of hinted at before, is not the hard part, really, because we have these generic tools. We have the Suzuki Trotter formulas. We have these very big hammer methods that are very general. We just apply them. So if you look at this Hamiltonian, you can see that it decomposes into a phi part and a pi part. So that's, remember, just in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, we decomposed our Hamiltonian into a momentum part and a position part. And so, like, you know, h pi is this part and h phi is this part. And this is diagonal in the position basis, which is the basis we're working in. So we can do this time evolution e to the minus I h phi delta t just by phase kickback, like on Saturday's lecture. And this one is diagonal in the Fourier basis, so we just Fourier each of these registers of qubits representing the different variables. Then we do our phase kickback. We just have to compute like the sum of the squares of these numbers, kick back a corresponding phase, and then Fourier transform back, and we build up this time evolution by alternating little time steps with phi and pi back and forth a la Suzuki Trotter. So that part's kind of solved. So what are the hard parts? What are the non-trivial things that we have to worry about? What's going to get us thinking about interesting topics? So there's really three things that you have to worry about. Yeah. Yeah, it does scale like that, and I don't know whether you can do better. Yeah, so the question was, it looks like the cost of the algorithm is going to scale with the volume of space measured in lattice units, and yeah, our algorithm does scale at least that badly. Now, you could ask, well, what about parallelization? Because you've got like different things going on at different points in space. Maybe you can have these being done by different parts of the quantum circuit at the same time. And that's probably true. The computer science way to phrase that is that this problem might be doable with low-depth quantum circuits. And that's kind of an alternative measure of complexity. Instead of counting gates, just counting like how many layers of gates do we need, which is also a reasonable metric. And we might score better in that regard, although we haven't really analyzed it yet. Okay, so what are the hard parts? So we have one, bounding discretization errors. Two, state prep. Three, measurement. So that's the plan for the rest of the lecture. Okay, so bounding discretization errors. This kind of sounds like some grungy technical issue that's going to be profoundly boring, but that expectation turns out to be completely wrong. In fact, this issue of bounding discretization error, at least the errors coming from spatial discretization, really plunges us immediately into the heart of quantum field theory and the essence of what it's really about and how it differs from what we're familiar with in terms of undergraduate non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So the idea here is we can think of a sequence of lattices. As always, what we're hoping with our discretization is that in the limit of lattice size becoming small, we converge to some kind of continuum limit. So here we have, say, lattice spacing A, some corresponding Hamiltonian HA. Here's some lattice spacing H over 2, some corresponding Hamiltonian HA over 2. And our hope is we keep doing this. We take A all the way to 0, and we're converging the continuum. We recover Lorentz invariants and all of those other nice properties. And so this is the essence of how our simulation will work. And it is actually also a way of thinking about what the definition of quantum field theories really is. There is a school of thought which was called the constructive quantum field theory perspective, where they try to do rigorous constructions of quantum field theories by this kind of procedure, a sequence of lattice models. And in certain very special cases, like 1 plus 1 dimensional 5/4, this was actually successful, but it's very hard, and it doesn't seem to be likely that this can be applied to a lot of real-world quantum field theories that physicists care about. But nevertheless, I think it's a good idea to know about because it gives you like a very sort of like a gold standard. Like, okay, this is a quantum field theory which is interacting, and yet we really understand it in a completely concrete way. So I think it's helpful to at least be aware of this stuff. And I'll kind of think from that point of view here. So the odd thing about when you try to construct a quantum field theory by a sequence of lattices like this is it's not just like in calculus where you want to make an integral by a sequence of Riemann sums and you just make the boxes smaller and it converges and everything works fine. What you find is that actually you have to tune the parameters in the Hamiltonian in a very careful way as a function of the lattice spacing in order to make it, first of all, converge to something, and second of all, you want what it converges to be an interacting theory, not just something with free particles that whiz right by each other obliviously. And so that's the funny thing about quantum field theory. This way of taking of limits is kind of different from what you knew from high school calculus. It's kind of like you have to tune the values of your integrand as a function of the size of your Riemann boxes, but that's just what you have to do. And this is called renormalization. So let's say, concretely, you have some lattice Hamiltonian here, which, you know, as we saw, it's like half this pi squared. So here's our Hamiltonian. Maybe there's a half here. Oh, I see, because there's an A over 2 here. Yeah, so A over 2, yeah. Good point. Okay. Yes, these ones were kind of, so maybe I'll call these M sub A over 2. Lambda sub A over 2. And so how do we understand how we have to tune these parameters as we go up to the continuum limit? One way to think about that is let's try to, given a Hamiltonian here, sort of follow this flow through Hamiltonian space in the opposite direction. Let's follow it down from short lattice spacing to long lattice spacing and compute, say perturbatively, what the effective Hamiltonian ends up on these degrees of freedom after you integrate out these extra ones up here. So when you do that, what you'll find, at least in these well-behaved quantum field theories like this one, is you have basically a Hamiltonian of the same form, except these coefficients m are going to take, and lambda are going to take on different values. They're going to vary as a function of the lattice spacing in a way that you can calculate. Plus, there's also going to be small corrections like phi to the sixth terms and higher derivative terms and so on, which in a sense have to do with the fact that now we've integrated out some degrees of freedom, there's going to be these little corrections, which means that this Hamiltonian is not absolutely local anymore. These old degrees of freedom sort of mediated some interactions between these ones. But if things are working nicely, it'll turn out that these corrections are going to be small. They're going to be shrinking as a function of this lattice spacing. And in particular, in the theories we looked at, phi-fourth in, say, one and two spatial dimensions, the leading error terms down here scale like the lattice spacing squared. So they're vanishing quadratically as you go up to smaller lattice spacing. These things right here correspond to our discretization errors in our algorithm. Yeah. So ultimately, right now, I'm kind of talking in the regular physics language, not in terms of quantum circuits. Right. So ultimately, what we do is we have some scattering problem that we want to solve. It's at some certain energy scale. And that tells us that, OK, we want to set our lattice spacing corresponding to some energy scale which is a little bit higher than that. And how much higher than that we need it depends on how much precision we're targeting. And so we kind of use these renormalization formulas to understand how we need to set our lattice spacing. So this business of kind of bounding these discretization errors and seeing how they scale, this is not really original to us. We're looking at it in a slightly unusual context, and the time is continuous, but space is discretized and so on. But these kind of calculations are already done by Szymanczyk back in, I think, the 70s maybe. So this is kind of a conceptual framework that helps us both understand one example of what we really mean by a quantum field theory, first of all, which I think is very helpful. And secondly, it helps us understand how to construct an actual discrete quantum circuit and bound the errors. So once we've done that, we can move on to our challenge number two, which is state preparation. And here is where we'll put into play this tool of adiabatic state preparation, which I've introduced a few minutes ago. So one nice thing is, if you set lambda equals 0, you get rid of this phi-fourth term, this Hamiltonian becomes purely quadratic in all these operators here. We've got pi squared, phi squared, and this is, once you discretize, this ends up being products of phis at neighboring sites when you discretize this derivative and square it. So Hamiltonians like that, you can just do a change of variables. Like, you could write this Hamiltonian as, this is a quadratic form. You have, think of pi as being a vector of like pi 1 to pi n. And similarly for phi. And this Hamiltonian is really pi vector transpose identity pi with some coefficient plus some quadratic form of phi transpose and phi. So what we can do is we can do a change of variables which diagonalizes this matrix here, at which point we just have a sum of harmonic oscillators. We just have H equals sum j omega j pi squared j plus phi squared j. I should probably put tildes on these because these new variables are linear combinations of the old ones. And so this, I called it a change of variables. If you want to sound fancy, you can call it a Bogoliubov transformation. It's basically a change of variables. So once we have this, this is like, first year quantum mechanics. We know how to solve quantum harmonic oscillators. The ground state of this is going to be a bunch of Gaussians, one Gaussian for each of these different modes. And back in, we transform linearly back into the original variables. We still have a Gaussian. It's just not a product of a Gaussian along this variable, a Gaussian along this variable. It's something like this, e to the minus phi transpose some matrix, call it, F and phi. So that's what our ground state looks like. So we know how to make the ground state of the free theory. We can just use kind of standard state preparation tricks. I won't go into it. But we can make Gaussian superpositions on a quantum computer. If you want to see one way of doing that, you can look at problem 3 or 4 on my problem set. But we'll just say we know how to do this. So here's an idea for how we could try to approach the state preparation problem. One, make free vacuum. Call this 1 prime, let's say, excite some wave packets there. This is also not a big deal because we know what the creation and annihilation operators are. We know everything about the free model, so we can do this. I'll call this 2. Okay. And then 3, adiabatically, turn on lambda. So now we take these particles and we're sort of gradually turning on these interactions. What that means, a way people describe this is now these particles become dressed by a cloud of virtual particles. Even the vacuum state itself transforms as we change lambda. But this is something we can try to do. And in fact, it does seem pretty promising because what's the mass gap of this Hamiltonian? Well, the ground state of this Hamiltonian is the vacuum. The first excited state of this Hamiltonian is a single particle at rest. So the difference between the lowest eigenvalue and the first eigenvalue is just m, the mass of the particle. That's some constant, and so when we have our adiabatic state preparation where the time cost of this scales us like 1 over gap squared, that's 1 over m squared, and we're in good shape. So then after that, we can use our Suzuki Trotter stuff to simulate the actual scattering process. And then 5, we can measure using phase estimation, and that I haven't told you about yet, but that's the last thing in this talk. Yeah?
I thought
you were preparing the excited wave packet, not the ground state. Yes, so that's true. So we're not preparing the ground state. It turns out that the relevant gap, that eigenvalue gap is a little bit of a red herring. The relevant gap, the smallest one to the other part of the spectrum, is basically coming from one particle splitting into 3. And in the ultra-relativistic limit, I think, if I recall correctly, this gap actually goes like m squared over p, where this is the incoming momentum. So that's true, yeah. That's what I should have, an issue I should have raised. Okay. Yes, that's something to worry about, and we did worry about it, and that's one reason our paper is 65 pages long. So the question was, what about the density of states, that there's a lot of things you can scatter into, and you have to kind of be careful about these issues. Okay, so that's the idea, and it sounds like a good idea, and it almost is a good idea, but there is one issue that comes up, which is something that Daniel Harlow kind of anticipated in one of his questions a few minutes ago, which is that we're not preparing an eigenstate anymore, we're preparing a wave packet. That's a superposition of different eigenstates. And so let's think carefully about what happens when we do adiabatic state preparation for a case like that. So here's some wave packet state. We have some amplitudes for different energy eigenstates of our free theory. So free, we'll call S equals 0. Remember, in our adiabatic thing, we think of S as going from 0 to 1. That's our change of parameter. So we could just say, like, oh, what we're simulating is that. We have an S in front of the lambda. And so what will happen when we do our state preparation is that we'll get dynamical phases on here. So we'll have J, alpha J, times right, so at the end of our adiabatic evolution, each of these individual eigenstates from the S equals 0 will be adiabatically taken to the corresponding eigenstate with S equals 1. In other words, lambda turned on. But along the way, we'll accrue some phase, which is like the integral of the energy. And we don't want these phases. A more physical way of describing this problem is, as we're doing this time evolution where we're turning on lambda, time evolution is happening. These wave packets, they don't just sit there. What do wave packets do? They propagate in the direction where their momentum is pointing, and they broaden. And both of these things are bad for our algorithm. We first of all don't want them to propagate while we're doing this turn on of lambda, because there's only so much space. And they might collide with each other prematurely. We might end up simulating scattering at some smaller value of lambda than what we really wanted to simulate. Let me draw a picture. So at t equals 0, s equals 0. Let's say we have a pair of wave packets with momenta pointing at each other so that we'll be able to simulate scattering later. And then we do our state preparation, our adiabatic time evolution, or more precisely, we simulate it on our quantum circuit. Then we're at some later time, capital T, S equals 1. Now it's the interacting theory. These wave packets will be way smeared out like this, and they might be on top of each other. So being on top of each other is bad because we can get premature scattering at lower values of lambda when lambda's not all the way turned on. Also, broad wave packets is not desirable, because imagine if these things are like right on top of each other at the moment when scattering is supposed to occur. The expected distance between these particles might not be small, right? So he just has these two diffuse clouds on each other. They could just very easily whiz right by. Our precision's not good. The particles could miss. And that's not so desirable for our simulation, because we want to, as quickly as possible, gain data about the non-identity part of the S matrix, you know, the part where the particles really do scatter. So if we're only seeing that very rarely, then we have to repeat our simulation many, many times before we actually learn anything non-trivial. So we really don't want this. The problem of premature collision we could maybe avoid by just making space really big and having long runways for these particles to go down while we're doing the turn-on. But we still have the problem of broadening, and that's furthermore undesirable because then you need a lot of qubits to store all those lattice sites. So what's our solution to this problem? Well, here we kind of like break with our tradition of like directly trying to imitate nature, and we just take full advantage of the fact that this is a simulation on a quantum computer, and we can do all sorts of outlandish things that nature would never do. And we make the most of that opportunity. What we do is we intersperse backwards time evolutions in between our forwards time evolutions. So what we do is we divide time into little steps. We do a forward time evolution for a small step, gradually ramping up our lambda as we go. Then we evolve backwards in time for that same amount of time, but with that current constant value of lambda, and then ramp up forwards and backwards constant, and ramp up forwards and backwards constant. And so if you look at, like, say, lambda versus t, it's like a sawtooth. And what you can show is that if you make these little sawtooths small enough, then this thing does converge. What happens is this adiabatic change of basis from the eigenbasis of the free theory to the eigenbasis of the interacting theory, that's just the same. That's done during this part of the sawtooth. So we haven't harmed that at all. But these backwards time evolutions, what they do is they wind back these dynamical phases that were accruing during this part. So here, the dynamical phase that we accrue in this little time step is like kind of the average energy, the energy integrated over this step. And here, when we go backwards, we're doing minus that time step times the final energy. And if these time steps are small enough, the final energy and the average energy for the little step are pretty much the same. And like, we can make it converge. We can show that. Well, so we have to be careful about our choice of wave packets. So what we used is little Gaussian envelopes times sine waves. And then what happens when we do this process is these things sort of like jiggle in place. They move a little bit and go backwards, move a little bit and go backwards. One of the things we have to be careful of is making sure that these things are not interacting. They do have like kind of these exponentially decaying tails, but we can sort of bound all the errors. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, my question was very good.
Yes. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, so if I recall correctly, I mean, so the state I think that we make is like, on the free theory, is like Fourier transform of our wave packet shape, call it, maybe I'm overloading psi here, but okay, I'll just go ahead with that. So like, say we want one particle, psi of x is like our amplitude for the particle to be in a certain place, so we Fourier transform that, and like, this is kind of what we make in the free theory. We choose this to be like a Gaussian times like e to the minus I some average p x times e to the minus x squared over 2 like sigma x squared, so some width. And one thing we can always do is if we don't want to deal with these exponential tails in momentum space, we can cut them off. We could say, okay, out to 6 standard deviations, we exactly follow this formula. After that, we just say, oh, amplitude 0. And just by kind of unitarity, we know that cutting off some exponential tiny tail on the wave function is not going to cause any harm. So that's something we can do. Okay. So that's state preparation, and let me just briefly comment on the last issue. What is it? Oh, okay. All right, so I'll stop there. That's how we prepare our states. That's our algorithm. Maybe we can extend it to other field theories, and thank you for your attention.
Okay, so I don't think we have more time for questions, so we can discuss during the coffee break, and let's thanks, Stephen, again.